Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a very special thank you to the Keith McNally Restaurant Group for supporting the No Goat Left Behind project. You can help support the project by visiting Mineta Tavern, Balthazar, or Polino's and trying one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every week at Wednesday at 11 a.m., we're talking live with experts and tastemakers and all sorts of interesting people in the food world about this concept of taste, what it is, how you get it, what it means, whether it's important, and also a lot of other food topics. We are a call-in show when we're live. Obviously, you can listen to us on heritageradionetwork.com in the archive, but Wednesdays at 11, you can call in and we're welcome to take your calls. The number you can dial is 718-497-2128. And again, we're talking about taste. And one of the concepts about taste that has always fascinated me is how different people enjoy and experience different tastes, different flavors, different dining and eating experiences, and especially people like chefs, professionals in the food world who are constantly looking for inspiration, evaluating experiences in different ways from myself, different ways from eaters in general, food enthusiasts. And so in talking with a friend who is a great chef recently, I thought, why don't we make that a topic of a show? The difference between how regular, ordinary, food-loving people enjoy a restaurant experience or what they experience and how they taste, and the way a professional has that same experience. And so I'm delighted to welcome on air with me today Chef Laurent Gras. Many of you may know him from his incredible blog. He was the chef of L2O in Chicago, which received 3 Michelin stars. And before that, he was at the 5th Floor in San Francisco, at Peacock Alley in Waldorf Astoria. And before that, he was just raising headlines and earning many Michelin stars in France for many restaurants, the names of which we'll talk about later. But welcome, Laurent. Thank you for joining us here in Bushwick at Roberta's.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Tell me, let's just start right out at it. When you go to a restaurant, I want to know what you are looking for, how you evaluate the experience. I mean, aside from just having a great time, are you always working when you're eating in a restaurant?
No, I actually never work when I go to a restaurant. It's always to have a good time, to enjoy good food. So it's important for us to select properly the restaurant we're going to eat, because okay, we don't want to be disappointed. So, you know, the selection is actually the hardest, you know, selecting the right restaurant for the right night and make sure that we're going to taste good product.
So what goes into that selection process? I mean, you probably have a network of people who tell you where to eat, but how do you decide what's important?
Well, it's just depend on what we want to eat that night. You know, it's basically, do we want to have a pizza? Do we want to have a steak? Do we want to have a fine dining experience? Do we want to have sushi? And then after that decision, then it's which place are we going to be?
Sure. So where have you been recently that you've enjoyed?
Well, last night we went to 11 Park in Madison. Which is on Madison Park.
Right, just received its 3rd Michelin star. Yeah. We'll talk about that later. Fortunate of you to have a reservation before results came out.
Yeah, we actually didn't plan on that, but you know, it was just a very great coincidence because the ambiance was wonderful last night.
And so, not to put you on the spot, but what did you think?
Well, we have a wonderful experience. Yeah. The overall experience was just wonderful. Very welcome, very well served, and then the food was excellent, very well prepared, a lot of details, very good ingredients, a very nice flow.
What did you eat?
We started with a lot of different amuse-bouche, from play on clams, some lobster croquettes, some lollipops made with beetroots and goat cheese, and everything was very tasty, very well executed. And then we start, you know, our meal. I started with langoustine, who was served raw as a sashimi style with a grape and a grape gelée. Then I moved to a loup de mer, prepare with white bean chorizo, a little bit of bouillabaisse sauce, and then we finish with a duck for two.
Uh-huh.
It was a good, you know, it was a very good choice. The duck was actually excellent.
Wow. So do you, maybe I should back up a minute. Do you think I'm nuts? Do you think you and your colleagues, other great chefs, eat out exactly the same or having the same experience in a restaurant? If you do, in fact, put your professional role aside when you're having dinner? Or are you looking for different things? Are you finding inspiration just accidentally? Do you see how things are prepared? And does that dissuade you, things that might be missed by the common eye or the common palate?
Yeah, I think I look for inspiration if I love the meal. If I love the meal, then I will be inspired. And then I will look, you know, to some of the detail, to some of the combination, to some of the ingredients used, and then maybe use into, you know, different preparations for myself, for the restaurant. But that's really not the goals. That's not the primary goals, to go and study the foods. It's right. Really to have a very good experience. Because, you know, when you're a young professional, and I think that's very interesting to say, that when you're a young professional, you never go to a restaurant. You don't have the time. You don't have the money.
Right.
I remember in Paris, all of the good restaurants were closed Saturday and Sunday, and that was my day off. I have no money, just enough to pay the rent and buy some very cheap food. So as a young professional, you have no experience on food. And then you get experience as, you know, growing and financially be a little bit more stable. So you start to go into restaurants. So, it really depends on your personal experience to say, you know, I know food, I understand food, I understand experience in the restaurant because I have many of them.
Right. Well, you've brought up something that I think is a fascinating piece of this conversation, and that is the role that class really plays in restaurants and in taste. So what you've said is that many people who go to become cooks obviously don't come from the world that dines in fine restaurants all the time and evolve and grow into that role. But with that comes, I think, some predetermination. I know for a fact that sometimes you think, well, obviously this person, this restaurant has never sat in this seat and had this experience. You, as a diner, sometimes you have that idea that a chef is cooking for himself or his colleagues or her colleagues, but not for the experience or the pleasure of the person there. One of the things that comes to mind is a comment I once heard Alan Richmond, who is a restaurant critic for GQ, of some controversial status, but a good friend and an interesting thinker nonetheless, and a very funny man. But Alan once said, when he was cooking dinner for a group of chefs, that he thought that he probably cooked better than most chefs ate. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's totally correct. You know, as a chef, you don't eat really very well. You know, as a groups, you give times, you buy products for the staff, but you know, it's very minimal. So, you know, it's good ingredients, minimal time for preparations, and then you mostly give everything for the dining experience, so for your guests. So at the end of the day, you have very, very good, very good ingredients, but very simple preparation, nothing right. unusual, something you can eat homes on a daily basis, and then you have a very short amount of time. So you have your meal in like 8 minutes.
Standing, eight minutes,
and that's your experience. And sometimes, you know, as a cook, you grow like this, and you eat like this for many years, and then sometimes, which is interesting, when you go in a restaurant, and then you sit down, and you have a nice, you know, setting, you almost feel uncomfortable,
right?
Because it's just so different
from
your daily life, which is very interesting. You know, it changes, you know, as you grow and you have more experience, and as you dine, you know, more and more into different places, that changes, you know, and then, you know, the experience become, you know, more agreeable. So, you know, you have a better feel, you have a better understanding, and then you have also points of view of the experience. But you know, the first experience in the fine dining for a young cook, it's just like something where I'm not sure you feel very comfortable about
right.
it. You know, which is interesting, because you're in that business
and you're making that experience
yeah.
for others. It's an interesting paradox, I think, and one that I think perhaps, as restaurants have evolved, and we'll talk about this a little bit later in the show, who's getting the stars, what type of dining experiences those are, perhaps is coming together, or at least in America, this idea, the idea of an open kitchen, the idea of a more casual but sophisticated experience, maybe some middle ground between the finest, most formal, stuffiest experience and what happens in the kitchen?
I'd have to say that the most change, you know, for the industry, that there is much more communications in restaurant business. You know, there is much more communication between the back of the house, which are the cooks, mm-hmm. with the front of the house, which are the waiter, okay. with the management team. So there is a lot more of communication, you know, share of information and better understandings for in which business you're working for. And I think that's help. And you can see now there are, you know, chefs serving foods. And as you mentioned, you know, open kitchen where the cooks and the self, they can see the guests, they can right. bring the food to the table, they can look at the people reactions, listen to people comments. So I think the world had changed for like 30 years ago when I almost, you know, started cooking, where you were in your kitchen and then that was it. You know, that was your station and that was the only information you were getting.
Interesting. I'll remind our listeners at home that you can call in to ask questions to Chef Laurent Gras about this topic or any topic, really. Don't ask him what he's doing next because he's promised not to, that there's nothing to tell. But the number is 718-497-2128. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. Let's talk a little bit about the different relationship or the different role of the diner in different dining experiences. I know I began by saying we were going to talk about the chef experience, but you've made me think about the Japanese model, which I know you're very familiar with and has influenced you in many ways, where, you know, at a sushi bar, you're not just seeing the chef, but you're really in some sort of dialogue, you know, gastronomic taste or otherwise, with the chef, and how that might change the dynamic between diner and cook and that communication that you mentioned.
I think that there is a relationship of confidence when you at the sushi bar and then you build a relationship with the sushi chef, then you become more confident, and then you, in a way, you let the sushi chef, you know, really cook for you, choose for you, and it kind of brings a higher level of appreciation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I felt that when I went to Sushi Yasuda a few weeks ago, then, you know, we start to order sushi at the beginning. And then at the end, you know, he was choosing whatever he felt, you know, we would like. And then we say, you know, whatever you feel, whatever is best.
Right. And, omakase, I'm yours, right?
Yeah, completely.
So let's talk about value and how you ascribe value to an experience. One of the things that I sometimes shock people by saying is that I believe that there are $5 meals that are total ripoffs, and there are $500 meals that are worth every penny. And the opposite is obviously true: $5 meals that are great and $500 meals that are total ripoffs. As a chef, what do you look for in value of experience besides just the utter enjoyment of the company and the people that you're eating with and the occasion that you're celebrating or the dinner you're having?
I think the overall experience, you know, you start looking at the setting of the tables, the quality of the plates, the staff in the dining rooms. You look, you know, how many staff you have in the dining rooms, and you can evaluate. That's going to be, you know, a service where it's going to be very attentive. You go in the dining room, you see 30 waiter, you say, you know, at least two or three waiter are going to work on my table. So you already have a sense that it's going to be a very, very attentive service. And then, you know, look at quality of ingredients. I think that's the most important for the experience, the quality of the ingredients beside the preparations. And you can, you know, already read on the menu and you know, sometimes see some unusual ingredients that, you know, as a professional, you know, and you say, wow, that's very special.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that value has gotten out of whack a little bit? I know in New York, everyone is always complaining about the price of fine dining experiences. Even historically in France, they've been in some ways unsustainable because of the price of labor and all of the price of the other inputs. I just happened to return from a trip to Scandinavia, and in Sweden, the prices are shocking. And I'm someone who isn't shocked often by what things cost because I know what's involved. But $650 for dinner in a little 22-seat restaurant with an open kitchen is a little bit of a surprise.
Yeah, you know, it can be. But, you know, when you're part of the restaurant business, you know that restaurant business, they have the smallest margin in businesses.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, the profit margin in the fine dining are very, very small. So most of where you get from your customer, you'll spend it.
Right.
You spend that money. You know, you spend that money to provide the best service, the best ingredients. You also want to improve the quality of your business, so you invest money into it. And at the end of the day, you know, the margin are extremely small. So, yeah, I think there is a value to any price. You know, when you go and you pay a pizza $5 and the pizza is great, then that's a good value. When you go in a restaurant and you have a $500 meal and the food was exceptional, you can identify, you know, exceptional products, wonderful preparation, attention to detail. Yeah, there is a value. There is no doubts in my mind, you know, and that's how I feel. You know, it's like everything. You know, you go in the store, you buy shoes, you spend $1,000 on shoes. 5 years later, those shoes are still new. Right. They have a great value.
Right. Well, thank you. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll talk about the new Michelin stars. Thank you.
J'aime ta couleur café, tes cheveux café, ta gorge café. J'aime quand pour moi tu danses, alors j'entends murmurer tous tes bracelets, jolis bracelets. À tes pieds ils se balancent. C'est quand même fou l'effet que ça fait de te voir rouler ainsi des yeux et des hanches. Si tu fais comme le café, rien qu'à m'énerver, rien qu'à m'exciter, ce soir la nuit sera blanche.
Welcome back. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. You can call in and ask questions about taste, about a chef's life, about anything regarding food to me or to my wonderful guest, Laurent Gras. The number to call is 718-497-2128. So it's just a coincidence and fortuitous that you happen to be joining us the day after the announcement of the new Michelin stars in New York. Yesterday was a day that made some people happy and some people a little less happy. But to the firmament of the three-star Michelin restaurant around the world, we have two new places to add this morning. One of them is 11 Madison Park, where you had a great meal last night, and the other is the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair, not too far from us here at Roberta's in Bushwick. That's not where the restaurant is. It's actually at Brooklyn Fair. Sorry. So as someone, I think it's great to have you here because as someone who has achieved three Michelin stars several times in France and also here most recently for your project L2O, an amazing seafood restaurant in Chicago, what do you think about the stars and as they're announced, but also the comparisons between the restaurant experiences you've had here and those you've seen elsewhere around the world, particularly in France? Do they stack up?
Well, you know, there are some, you know, there are for sure some difference. You know, the restaurant business here in the States, it's very different from restaurant business in Europe. And you know, you can really, you know, feel that when you travel by the size. You know, in Europe, the reservation are open at 8 o'clock and they close at 10 o'clock. Here in the U.S., they open at 5 o'clock and sometimes they close at 11. So, you know, the economics are very different. The goals are very different. But at the end of the day, you know, I think the overall experience remain very close. You know, the Michelin has some very high standard for three Michelin star, which I don't really know exactly. But I know the goals. You
of
know,
course, as being, and as you've being received them three times under your watch. So,
so, but you know. Michelin is a reference. He's a reference around the world. He kind of bring together the highest quality restaurant around the world with the same topics, the same kind of experience, which is a small restaurant to a large restaurant, which is a very luxury restaurant to a more casual. You know, a three star is a level of experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think anywhere you achieve 3 stars as a chef, you can be very proud of yourself.
Indeed. Indeed. And I should say that now there are 7 3-star restaurants in New York City, and they are, just for the record, Jean Georges, Massa, Danielle, Percy, Le Bernardin, and the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair, and 11 Madison Park, obviously an incredible group to be a part of. It's funny because as I had said, I was in Sweden just recently, and there in Scandinavia, there's never been a 3-star restaurant. And with all of the attention that's been put on those countries for the excitement of the cuisine that they're doing now, everyone wants to be the first one because they believe it will be, and rightfully so, a historic event, yes. So even though they try to tell you they don't care, it's an underlying, every conversation you have, sort of, it's in the back of every young and ambitious chef's mind. We should say, what do you think the impact is here? I mean, of the Michelin Guide, obviously in Scandinavia, it's huge. In France, it's still huge. I know chefs are really proud and rightfully so to be included in the cadre. Do you think it means something? Is a GATT as important? Does the time out really matter? What matters as a cook? What are you looking for?
I think everything matters. Uh-huh. You know, I think it's a combination of everything. You know, you look at, you know, local recognitions and local appreciation from a local magazine. You look at the New York Times, which is more national, and then you look at more international, which is the kind of Michelin guides, and then, you know, the Zagat, which is also local and international, right, and soon international. So everything matter for a restaurant which is a 3-star Michelin caliber restaurant. You know, the economy is very important in those places. You cannot have any empty seats every night. So everything matter.
Right.
You know, to an economic standpoint, you know, any review is very important. And I think as a chef, you care about your guests. You know, you care about your guests. You care about each single experience, which include critics, which you not necessarily know they're in the dining room. So,
right. So you have to pay attention. You have to do your business and to do your job and to have your career. You need to pay attention.
And I think you want to. You know,
right.
I think as a chef operating a 3-Michelin-star restaurant, you really want to take care of every detail. You really want to make sure that every single plate, every single experience is just wonderful. Mm-hmm.
I know there are some incidences where chefs have chosen not to accept the pressure that comes with that, or the expectation, or for some reason felt that the responsibility and having to maintain a certain aura related to the stars was not to their, perhaps to their taste, so to speak.
Yeah.
Could you explain what that might be a little bit for people at home who might be a little less familiar with the whole system?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Michelin camps come once a year. And then during the year, they send inspector to review a restaurant, you know. And I will say, you know, on the 3-Michelin-star restaurant status to be attributed with a 3-star the following years, you know, the guide will come at least 5 or 6 times, up to, you know, more times if they feel they need it. So, you know, it's a constant pressure. You know, the Michelin, keeping the 3-Michelin-star will say it's harder to keep them than to get them. Because, you know, when you get them, it's kind of a surprise. It's your hard work for many years. To keep them, you go to another level. So you compete with the best restaurant, the best chef. And of course, there is a new pressure.
Right. A pressure under which some people, perhaps like you, thrive, given your experience. Let's change the topic a little bit, almost diametrically opposed, but not unrelated to this phenomenon that I know you have been riding for the year that you've been back in New York from Chicago. And that's this idea of the pop-up restaurant, or the guest chef for a night in a place, in an existing restaurant, or as we did, you launched the James Beard Foundation pop-up earlier this year with an incredible week of dinners. What's appealing about that to you, and how have you enjoyed your time bouncing around as the peripatetic chef from place to place?
I think that the most appealing is the social connection, with chefs, with the industry, and with also a different networks of customer, which you not necessarily will have in your restaurant. So I think pop-ups are one night or two nights or 5 nights, like we did at the Beard, and then it's over, it's gone. So it's also something very quick in, mm-hmm. in the time, and that's not going to happen again in some sense. Or if it will happen, it will be a very different experience.
Right.
Also,
it makes me think of Joe Baum, the great American restaurateur who gave us the Four Seasons and the late Windows on the World, who was the first to really take this idea of all restaurant is theater really to heart.
Yeah.
Because theater comes and goes, and you either see it or you didn't, and that partly affects the experience you have. And And certainly at the Beard Foundation pop-up at JBF Limited, there was a sense each night it wasn't about the money, but the access, being fortunate for having been in the room to have had this unique experience.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think entertainment is, you have to account for that in creating a meal or that temporality, that quickness to, have we become kind of bored with restaurants and we need to do that? Or just think chefs are bored? Or is it all just part of the evolution of dining?
I think it's just part of the evolution. Yeah. You cannot say you're bored in New York with 10,000 restaurants.
But there's still nowhere to eat ever, which is the irony that no one understands when you travel, right? I'll remind everyone we have a few minutes left if you're interested in reaching us. We are at 718-497-2128. So next week, our topic on the show is going to be sustainability, because the Beard Foundation is putting on a conference called Sustainability on the Table, How Money and Media Influence the Way America Eats. And we'll be talking about that, and you'll be joining us there. And in just a couple of minutes, I know it's an issue that that is problematic in some ways. It isn't. One of the things I've always said to people when we have conversations about the topic is that chefs operating at the highest level are doing, as you said, things at the most sustainable, most exclusive, by definition, way, working with the best farmers, the most local ingredients, because they're able to pay for the things that everyone else can't, and that's a big issue. But can you comment a little bit about what the challenges are as a chef in negotiating sustainability or local foods, or what your vision is about it?
I think as a chef, you have some moral and social obligations. You know, you need to be aware of what's around you, what's happening around you. You need to, you know, if you are, you know, in this industry as a chef, as a leader, as part of a 3-star Michelin, you know, concept, you know, people are going to follow what you do. So I think it's important to make right decisions for what is happening around you, and make sure that people who are going to follow you can understand that, you know, can understand what are the reasons. So I think communication is also important. Communicate why you do, how you do it, and why you're doing it. I think it's the most important.
And just the other day, someone mentioned that one of the important aspects of being a chef is teaching, the moment to teach. It was actually Michael Anthony, the chef of Gramercy Tavern. So you have all these opportunities, both in your kitchen and also in your dining room, to make those, to communicate in that way, to show, to lead, as you said, as a chef.
And to lead your team also, and to teach them, and to make them understand that this is what we do, and there's a reason for it. You support the farm, or you don't buy fish which is overfish, which is not a very good decision. But you know, there is also needs. You know, there is also needs in your restaurant where that's what your customer wants. They want to they want to add that kind of food. They want to add that kind of experience. And sometimes, sustainability, it's hard to, look at 100%.
Of course, right. And I think that's true in everyone's day-to-day life and everyone's professional life.
Sure. For example, I go to Massa, what I'm expecting, it's the best fish, and the best fish are not maybe all the fish which are sustainable,
Right. But he just needs one of them. There aren't that many people there. But of course, that's not an argument that you can make. Well, thank you so much. I know, any hint about what you're up to next? I know it's the question that everybody wants. What are you thinking about your next project will be? It will be in New York, I presume?
Yeah, it will be in New York. So, we'll figure it out, in the coming few weeks or coming few months.
Oh, so there's even a timeline on that. So perhaps when we figure it out, or just before, we'll have Laurent back. Thank you for joining us today. I'll tell everybody, as I mentioned, that next week we have two interesting guests who have helped plan the nuts and bolts of the James Beard Foundation's second annual food conference. Karen Karp, who is the president of Karp Resources and who is a sometimes guest host on the show, she'll be hosting our November 2nd show, will be joining me along with Joseph McIntyre, who's the president and founder of an organization in California called Ag Innovations Network. And we'll be talking about this issue of taste vis-a-vis sustainability, perhaps less at the highest level of a great three-star restaurant and more how we take the values that chefs at those highest levels have and apply them to the broadest stretch of people who eat. One of our participants in the conference serves 55 million people a day. That's a little bit more than you can fit around a chef's table in the kitchen. So we'll have an interesting conversation next Wednesday at 11 a.m. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Chef, maybe one... I hear the music, so I think they're following my cue. No. Bring it on. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.com. This is Mitchell Davis. Join us next Wednesday at 11 a.m. for Taste Matters, because it does.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event.